The first time that I ever met a hitman was in August of 2008. I was working on this piece about organized crime in the Indian tech capital of Bangalore for a magazine called Wired. At the time, Bangalore had this problem. It was absolutely exploding in terms of profits, in terms of growth. And think of this nice, blue, gleaming glass and steel tech center surrounded by farmlands, the clash of medieval cultures, and this global economy. And in order to expand, literally, that gleaming steel hot core had to take over some of that farmland. It had to build these tech centers for places like IBM and Apple and Accenture and really major global firms. They literally needed land. But the land was locked up in a million feudal claims. Claims that go back, in some cases, thousands of years, divided by hundreds and thousands of different parties. And the Indian court system, well, it just couldn't handle the load. If you went to try to sell your parcel of farmland, it would get tied up in endless litigation. So there had to be, a fast solution to settle land disputes. And this is where organized crime and the mafia, they came in. They essentially monetized this alternative justice system, a situation where the mafia don would, talk to different cousins and, brothers and sisters, each party who had some claim on the land. And because the prices were booming, he would say, look, here's how it's going to go. You over there, cousin A, you're going to get a certain amount of money. Cousin B, you're going to get a certain amount of money. And I'm going to take my cut for settling this dispute. If any of you want to bring this up again, I'll kill you. And you know what? It worked. This alternative justice system was so much more efficient than the courts that if you wanted to buy land in Bangalore, you didn't bother going through your real estate agent to secure the transaction. You went to the mafia don. And at the time, there were two dons operating in Bangalore, each with their own impressive body counts and court cases and criminal allegations against them. One was this guy named Agni Sridhar. And if you wanted to characterize Agni Sridhar in sort of a political perspective, he was the leftist don, maybe communist sympathies. And there was this other don named Muthappa Rai. He was more of the Republican don, the conservative guy. And they both had thick ties into the government. And it took me months to finally track down ways to interview these two dons who were, sort of at war with one another, each wanting to take their own significant piece of the pie. And when I rolled up to Agni Sridhar's house, he was meeting with a member of the parliament upstairs, and I had to wait outside. And outside, there was this guy in these sort of wraparound shades and a big gold chain. That was Mallama Lokesh. He opened his trunk and showed me these wickedly sharp swords, and he told me this story of how not so long ago he'd hacked someone to death by riding up next to him on his motorcycle and kicking that guy off his motorcycle, and then his gang of sword-wielding bandits chopped up the guy who disputed his land claim. I interviewed Agni Sridhar, and a day or two later, I interviewed Muthappa Rai, who was even more scary. Before I went to meet him, because I was going to ask him about his murder record, before I went to meet him, I sent a message to my editor back at Wired Magazine, and I said, look, if you don't hear from me in 12 hours, you have to call this one cop that I'd been talking to, and I forget this cop's name, but he, you know, he was another well-known figure in Bangalore. He was the sort of cop who didn't operate in the normal legal playbook. He was a cop with, you know, a big body count of his own under his belt, and he was known to shoot first and ask questions later. And I figured if something went wrong with me, this was the cop that I wanted to go, you know, check into my own personal safety. And I arrived at Matapurai's gate, and I was surrounded by guys with shotguns and pistols. And I interviewed Matapurai. I asked him about his business. And that article ended up in Wired. It was called The Godfather of Bangalore. And it was one of the early pieces in my career, one of these hardcore, hard-hitting pieces of investigative journalism. I'll put a link down in the description so you can read it for yourself. It's a great yarn. But that's not the reason why I'm telling you this story, because there's actually this subtext to that mafia piece, which is actually, well, it sheds light on a bigger issue than the mafia, and it's how you get your information. Because there's this parallel story that's happening while I'm going out to interview these people who could kill me. Which is actually a pretty common experience in my 20s. I did these stories that were legitimately dangerous, interviewing organ brokers, interviewing child traffickers, people who would kill me without really facing many repercussions of their own. Well, the funny thing is that in many cases, I was actually far less scared of that, you know, child soldier with the AK-47 than I was of my editor back sitting in some cushy office in San Francisco. And I know that sounds weird, but you have to understand that I think that this is something that a lot of freelance reporters feel. You know, we don't get paid very much for this work. I think for that story, The Godfather of Bangalore, I made about $4,500 for 6 months of work and the potential of getting shot. And because of the way contracts work with those big publishers, if I didn't deliver the goods in a way that the editor wanted, like, they could just kill the story. And I would only get paid 25% of what my contract stated. So it was theoretically possible that I would go through these intense situations and walk away with like $1,000 in my pocket for almost getting killed. And that to me was just as scary and terrifying as the person that I was talking to who was holding the pistol. You know, because you invest your life in these stories. You have an idea and you want to get it to your editor. It goes through a pitch process. It's really hard to get a story in a magazine like Wired, and they can kill it for any reason. They can kill it because, a president said something that was shocking, and there just wasn't space for it in the magazine, and your mafia story wasn't as important as, say, or an earthquake in Morocco, right? It wasn't as important as these other pieces. Or maybe when you were out there, you weren't able to really connect what was happening in this foreign country to an American business interest. Like, if I couldn't show that IBM was somehow working with Matapurai, well, my piece might not get published, and then I might not be able to eat. And my wife, who was, you know, in a city not far from Bangalore, who was working at an NGO that I was supporting, well, we would be in trouble. And that was terrifying. It was just as terrifying and as an existential threat as the literal threat in front of me. This is the hidden subtext of a lot of the journalism that you know and love and where you get information for things that are happening on the other side of the world. These days, a lot of journalism is done by freelancers who don't have like a salary coming from that, you know, large media enterprise. You know, Condé Nast, that's the media company that owns Wired or the New York Times or any of these other things. You're sort of on your own as you're out there. And I know so many reporters who are in war zones. They're in Syria, they're in Iraq, and they're just as worried as what's happening back in the home office as they are from the shrapnel that has killed some of my colleagues. And, you know, as I worked in India, I was there for 6 years, 3 years as a reporter. That always scared me as much as the actual threats that were in front of me. And this is actually something that has bigger impact on the way you consume media and how media is produced than you might think. Because that relationship that the reporter had to the means of distribution and the money of that distribution is really relevant to how media gets created. And at that time, in 2008, you could say that the media was still very centralized. There were several big players who made crazy profits by selling advertisements on the writing that the reporters made. You know, at the time, Wired was selling single pages in their magazine for like $80,000 for a page of like, you know, sort of a watch or, you know, a new type of car. I was getting paid about $4,500. And the reason I did it, aside from that sort of paltry amount of money that I would make just for writing those words, is that I would have the opportunity to maybe turn this work into a book sometime or some other relationship that I would maintain with another big publisher like HarperCollins or Penguin. And somehow this would all add up to a career. I mean, sure, Condé Nast could have their giant building in Times Square at the time, but I would at least, you know, be able to make rent. Now, I do have a lot to say about how the money operated in the freelancer-editor relationship, but that's not really what I want to talk about here as much as how that centralized distribution, which is, of the media, which is where, you know, my work would go through, how that is changing and how that is changing the nature of content production and the nature of the information that you receive as a listener, as a reader, as a viewer. Because we are going through a true revolution in media right now that is about as significant as what happened when the Gutenberg presses first started coming into Europe at the very beginning of the literacy boom. And it's been brewing for a while, and I promise you it is going to change so much that you may not even recognize the media landscape in just a few years. I believe that we are witnessing the death of the mainstream media as we know it. And it's because of two things. It's one, between the relationship between the media producer, so the journalist in this case, and those big institutions that used to be able to distribute things like magazines to the world and broadcast news channels. It's going to be that relationship between those two people and also the relationship between viewers like you, people who listen to this stuff and watch this stuff, and how they get their content in the first place. Now, there's a certain strain of political thought championed by theorists like Noam Chomsky that I think I want to address first. And to summarize, the idea is that big money controls the media agenda writ large. That because the media is owned by just a few players, those few players, and most notably their owners, the owners set the agenda. The way this theory goes, it's almost like there's this Illuminati controlling the flow of information into your brain, and they tell journalists what stories they're supposed to write. I would say that by and large, that is not my experience of being a reporter in the media. I have only maybe once or twice had a story killed because of something that I felt was like an agenda that I couldn't comprehend coming from the top. And I've certainly never had something like a pharmaceutical company getting involved and telling me that I couldn't report on organ trafficking or their new controversial drug. Usually, editors have worked pretty well for me. That relationship, besides the money, has actually turned out okay. In fact, I've had editorial support, I've had fact checkers, I've had legal review. Because centralized media had so much money in it, remember that Wired was making $80,000 for just one page of ads? Well, that translated into some good journalism. And I would say that the quality of the content that I produced with Wired and Mother Jones, NPR, it's all really, really high because of the size of that system. And while I'm sure that to some degree those big media players do set some agenda, on a day-to-day basis, I don't think it's as prevalent as at least the narrative in society has grown to believe that all journalists are shills working on someone else's narrative. Instead, I think there's a better way, a better theorist to look at who better describes what's happening in the media in general. And he was this, you know, famous, just crazily famous social media theorist that you might have never heard of. His name is Marshall McLuhan. And I happen to have a copy of his book that I keep right next to my desk. It's called Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man. Oh man, this is a good read. It's a little antiquated. My book smells old. But his basic idea is just as revolutionary right now as it was back when he was first writing. And it is this, to be summed up in just one line, it's that the medium is the message. And to summarize his thoughts, you know, very succinctly, it's that it doesn't really matter what you actually listen to. It's not the content of the stuff that comes into your brain. It's the fact that you're listening or acquiring this content through a particular type of technology. Basically, it's that technology creates an environment for that information to get into your head, and it's so much more important than what that content actually says. It puts the environment before the words, and that's just like a different way to think about things. I'm going to play you a clip that Marshall McLuhan gave to the Australian Broadcasting Network, you know, in, I think it was 1977, to let you just hear the way he thinks, and then I'm going to read some passages from his book.
When you say the medium is the message, does that leave any room at all for criticism of individual, say, television programs?
Or content.
Yes.
You see, it doesn't much matter what you say on the telephone. The telephone as a service is a huge environment, and that is the medium. And the environment affects everybody. What you say on the telephone affects very few. And the same with radio or any other medium. What you print is nothing compared to the effect of the printed word. The printed word sets up a paradigm, a structure of awareness which affects everybody in very, very drastic ways, and it doesn't very much matter what you print as long as you go on with that form of activity.
And isn't that sort of crazy? The idea that it doesn't matter what you write, it's the fact that you're writing it that we have to pay attention to? And he saw like everything in terms of its environment, the environment that it creates. I'm going to read you just a passage from the intro to Understanding the Media so you can get like a flavor of what he's talking about, how big this really, really is. Quote, "The instance of the electric light may prove illuminating in this connection. The electric light is pure information. It is a medium without a message, as it were, unless it is used to spell out some verbal ad or name. This fact, characteristic of all media, means that the content of any medium is always another medium. The content of writing is speech, just as the written word is the content of print, and print is the content of the telegraph. If it is asked, what is the content of speech? It is necessary to say, it is an actual process of thought, which is in itself nonverbal. An abstract painting represents direct manifestation of creative thought processes as they might appear in computer designs. What we are considering here, however, are the psychic and social consequences of the designs or patterns as they amplify or accelerate existing processes. For the message of any medium or technology is the change of scale or pace or pattern that it introduces into human affairs. The railway did not introduce movement or transportation or the wheel or road into human society, but it accelerated and enlarged the scale of previous human functions, creating totally new kinds of cities, new kinds of work and leisure. And maybe people who've been following me for a little while can understand why I love Marshall McLuhan so much. I mean, this is the same sort of thing that I talk about in my book, The Wedge, right? This is the same thing, the way I talk about human consciousness as all interconnected, and that the way we think is informed by our neurology, and it's informed by consciousness writ large as a big, interconnected everything. And it's certainly true, right? I mean, we don't really remember what particular broadcasts were being sent out in 1925 over the airwaves. We barely remember any of that stuff. But the fact that the messages were moving over airwaves foreshadowed the television revolution, a broadcast of towers that sent out TV signals into these narrative streams, these uninterrupted centralized broadcasts that gave way to eventually cable television. Again, these central streamers coming out with cables to your house. And you would sit down and you'd watch and you'd flip through channels. And that's the way you got your information. That changed the way your activity patterns worked. It changed the way you related to people and the sources of information themselves. And the characteristic that I think is most important about that particular medium, the medium where I grew up with, I was born in 1978 at the height of broadcast and the transition into cable. And everything was actually owned, like Noam Chomsky pointed out, by a few central players who were deciding more or less what could go on the air, or even more importantly, what the type of information that could go on the air. And your relationship to that as a listener, well, you just had to go along with whatever was being said. There was this uninterrupted transmission of information. Same with newspapers. You didn't talk to the newspapers. There was no comment section. You'd have to physically write a letter to give feedback to the newspaper. It was a different world entirely. And then came the internet, and the world would never be the same again. But before I tell you about how the internet is changing things and how the media is going to be very different in just a few years, I am going to take a break for, you know, the equivalent of an advertisement, what this podcast does as an advertisement. Now, if you're listening on YouTube, you may be getting ads already, but this podcast lives and breathes on Spotify and Apple. And if you're not listening to it there, well, maybe think about subscribing because, well, I release these podcasts there first. You could say it's the medium of choice. And I'm going to ask you for two favors right now that help me keep this ad-free. The first favor is for the people who really are getting a lot out of this show. I have a Patreon, which is that model of newfangled journalism, which we are going to talk about when this ad segment ends, where you will support this show in return, get early access to my thought process as it comes together. It's pretty cheap. I think it's like 10 bucks a month. And it helps support everyone who listens for free and lets me keep on doing something that I love. Join on Patreon, and there is an exclusive Discord community and a direct line to talking to me about getting guests that you might want to hear me interview right on this show. So check out Patreon down below. And if you're not one of those people who's going to just jump right in and do that, I get it. There's a lot of shows that I don't directly support, even shows that I love. And so for you, lovely people, I have another request for you. Would you consider doing the social media dance on this podcast? And what that means is because there's algorithms out there, and I'm going to talk about these algorithms in a second in more detail, but likes and comments and reviews matter both to the computer that sort of serves this content out into the world, and it matters to other people who are looking for like a new podcast or show. If they see a certain number of likes, you might be more likely to actually give it a listen. So do that thing. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can even leave a review. And if it's a 5-star review, I will read it here on this channel live, or maybe not live. This is not live. This is a recording. And so I'm going to read some of these reviews to you right now. Here's a username, TJ6959. Damn, Scott, such an inspiration with regards to discussing various intriguing topics that no one else mentions. Another one by Omar Massa, 1021. Keep up the good work, Scott. And now another one, user, well, with a long string of numbers behind his name. Please, I am interested to join the Illuminati. Well, I can't help you join the Illuminati, man. But those interactions actually do matter. So if you can put something in those comments, you'll have a chance for me to read it here live on the air, and you help me out. So please go consider doing that. Please consider Patreon. And now I'm going to run right back in to how the internet has changed things and how it's going to get so much, well, different in the next few years. So we were talking about how the medium is the message, and we talked about how central broadcasting sort of formed the way you received information, and then boom, the internet came out. Now, the internet came out in, I guess, 1992, right? That's when I first got my email address and I was on AOL and that stuff. And well, the centralized media had to respond, and the changes were, well, they were slow at first. No one really knew how it was going to work. So newspapers put their content out for subscription at first, and then very, very quickly those subscriptions went away for free distribution straight online. And content, which writ large, all content was essentially free to consume. And that became a deal with the devil. And an extreme lack of foresight. I mean, can you imagine? And we're talking like 1999 here. A place like the New York Times was making 30, 40 bucks a month on your daily newspaper subscription that would be delivered to your door in like literally a dead tree it was printed on. That was the medium. And then you could just go to your computer and get like any story on that whole site totally for free through the internet. Well, they just didn't have the foresight to realize that this is where things were going. And it wasn't just the New York Times. It was really everyone was trying to compete for eyeballs on the internet. It was all these big players. It was magazines and newspapers that aren't even really around anymore. And it took years for those magazines and newspapers to realize that they had made a big error. And I didn't really see subscriptions coming up, like digital subscriptions, until about like before COVID, like a couple years before COVID, where you couldn't read, say, The Atlantic without paying whatever they charge, $6 a month or whatever. And that distribution change, it changed how you interacted with the information that you were getting as a reader. And there were some people at that time saying, look, this change in the medium is going to change the way I create content. And a few people were really prescient, and they went on writing blogs and video channels and podcasts. And the early adopters, well, they sort of became mini celebrities, and they were competing, and this is really, really critical, on somewhat of a level playing field with those big players. They were just URLs that you could go to, and going to that URL of the New York Times or the Daily Kos took exactly the same amount of energy. But maybe the New York Times still had just better stuff, so Daily Kos didn't get quite as much traffic. But it was still just one guy, and the traffic that he did get, he could monetize through ad. But the ad models were also, well, they were really different. In the days of print, you never really knew who was going to be, you know, influenced by that 80,000 page ad in Wired, the $120,000 page ad in Vanity Fair, or the $100,000 full page broadsheet for the New York Times. Those were the actual prices that advertisers were paying for print advertisement. Well, internet ads worked on different algorithms, right? You could actually see who clicked on what, how many eyeballs actually mattered. And well, I think advertisers realized that eyeballs weren't worth what they thought they were before. And all of these ad prices in print started collapsing. And it took a surprising amount of time to see the current death spiral that the media is currently in. When I was that freelancer in India, I would pitch all of the different magazines when I had a really good story. And I could pitch, well, a lot of them. You know, sure, there was Wired, which is where I really made my bones, but I also write for Mother Jones and NPR. But there were a ton of other magazines like Details, Playboy, X-Ray, Salon. There were tons of these different magazines that paid decently. Like, you could get $1 to $3, sometimes even $5 a word to write for these magazines, which felt really good as a writer. I think when I was starting, Life magazine might have even still been around. And by and large, most of them are gone. And with them being gone, also went that institutional support that used to be there. You know, it used to be when I would write for, say, Wired, there was a dedicated fact-checking team. And Wired might still have a fact-checking team, but it's much smaller than it used to be. The New Yorker still runs a great fact-checking team. But I know another magazine, say like Men's Health, it seems that they have they share fact-checking teams with other magazines, and there's less effort put into things. And certainly web stories, web-alone stories, don't get nearly the attention that they used to in terms of editorial support. And the biggest driver for all of this wasn't just the existence of the internet with its interconnected cables, fiber optic cables, connecting your computer to centralized services that would distribute bits and bytes and packets of information. The biggest change was probably actually social media in 2005. Facebook comes on the market, and it just sort of spreads around the world. And the crazy thing is that when people posted stories on a social media network like Facebook, it would appear in the same feed as, say, the New York Times, and habits were changing. People weren't getting their news directly from the New York Times anymore. You didn't wake up. I used to wake up and read the morning paper, and then I would wake up and I would go to the New York Times URL or the Providence Journal, where, you know, that's where I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and I would go to those URLs first. But now people check their social media feeds first, and next to that story on, I don't know, something about the Biden administration, whatever they're doing right now, it's right next to your friend's social media post. You know, they're eating a fantastic meal. They've got a six pack. They're in a sauna. They have a new diet technique. I don't know. Whatever happens on social media. And that feed that medium has fundamentally changed because now there is a parity between what was happening in those big central media broadcasting empires and just the blather that occurs on social media feeds. And right now, Gen Z, this is that younger generation, which is, you know, I guess they're in their 20s now. There's a generation underneath them too. But they get most of their information primarily from these social media feeds, which means that the New York Times and the LA Times and Wired and everybody is competing for that same sliver of attention. And it's really, really hard to do. The centralized media broadcasters are dying because of this, and it's actually taken them a lot longer to die than I had initially anticipated. But as a journalist, I can tell you, I can see the rumblings from the inside because I'm talking to the editors and I'm watching the layoffs, and things are about to get crazy. One change that became noticeable a few years ago is that reporters who had large social media followings on Twitter or Instagram and more recently TikTok, they got the better salary packages. They were the ones who were more likely to get stories commissioned by the big magazines because there had that social media clout, because these magazines had to compete for attention. And they know that they had a certain amount of followers, you know, a certain number of people follow, say, the Wired social media feed. But they could get more clout if they worked with a well-known reporter. And certain reporters started to get more power inside those institutions. And this was, in a way, a good thing, maybe. At least it was a good thing in terms of where I came up, right? When I was doing that mafia story that I began this podcast about, I would be talking with these mafia bosses, but I had no way to get that information out into the world other than through Wired Magazine's pages and their own print distribution channels. Well, some reporters were learning that their social media influence was just as important as the social media influence from Condé Nast, from Hearst, from Penguin. And man, things were really changing. It wasn't just the prediction of things changing, you know, Stuart Brand, you know, people were talking about this in the 2000s, but now we were actually seeing it happen. There were actual YouTube celebrity journalists who were just as important. And they were single people controlling this flow of information. They were starting to make money on ads. And one thing that's really interesting about that is that single journalists needed a lot less money than those big players in order to operate and produce their content. I would write a 5-page story for Wired and I'd get like $4,500. And they would sell 5 pages for what? $400,000? There's a big arbitrage opportunity for the individual reporter if they could amass enough social media following to make it profitable. And, you know, YouTube ads and Twitter economics, you know, it doesn't make nearly as much as what you would make in those mainstream outlets, but it was potentially enough. I mean, about 1 million downloads on YouTube, 1 million watches generates, I think, about roughly $4,000. And I don't think any of my YouTube videos have gotten anywhere even close to that number, but there are people who can do that regularly, and they were smaller shops. So the difference between those big centralized players and those little players, well, it just played to the advantage of the small producers. And now we're at a tipping point where everything really is changing. Just a few days ago, Vice, the former sort of porn magazine out of Toronto, turned into mega broadcast channel with things with a whole TV show on HBO. Well, they declared bankruptcy. They were valued at I think $1 billion like 5 or 6 years ago. And now they're out of business. channels like Vox, which, you know, they produce some good journalism here and there. They had these Vox stars like Johnny Harris, who now has his YouTube channel, which is bigger than Vox. One guy versus a company that was funded by hundreds of millions of dollars. That's the power of social media. It's also the curse of social media. And another thing that has been happening in this sort of broader media ecosystem is that as newspapers shed all of their profits from advertising, these, I guess you could call them hedge funds and conglomerates, they would come in and they would buy up old papers and divide them up and sell their assets and gut these old institutions. And I'm thinking in particular the Denver Post. I live in Denver, and we had this great paper called the Denver Post, which had a big building in downtown Denver, and a company called Bain Capital. When you hear the words Bain Capital, there should be like an audience booing behind you. Bain Capital came in and, you know, kicked the journalists out of their nice real estate, relocated them to like a garage in a neighboring town, and systematically tried to fire journalists and maximize profits. And those editorial standards crumbled. And they bought paper after paper after paper. And, you know, Denver used to have two major newspapers. The other was the Rocky Mountain News. Yeah, that's gone. And newspapers all around the country are dying of similar death spirals of sad news stories. Once formidable papers that can no longer afford a staff. Well, one interesting thing is occurring is that sometimes these reporters collectivize and they go outside and they create a new institution. And in Colorado, one of these is called the Colorado Sun, which was like former Denver Post reporters who now have this like small little collective and they're getting the subscription models. And actually, the Colorado Sun is doing better work than the Post because they are smaller and they are more nimble. And they get to work out of their home offices, so they don't have that sort of footprint that they needed before. Well, good journalism's happening in those places. Vice, which I mentioned just now, went bankrupt, and a whole bunch of journalists jumped ship and created something called 404, where it was just a couple people with a little bit of social media clout redoing, I think it was called the Motherboard. They redid the Motherboard and now they're putting it out in their own small way. And that's the future of media that we're looking at right now. And it's not just in my small world of journalism, it's hitting everyone. Right now, there is a strike going on in Los Angeles among writers. The writers are on strike. And there was this really interesting article in the Washington Post, again, legacy media, that talked about how this was actually changing the ground underneath writers' feet. The article was called The Rise of the Creator Economy. I'm going to read you a passage. They're talking about the people who are on the strike lines right now as the mainstream, the Netflixes of the world are sort of shut down. Here's what it said. The fast-growing cast of amateur and professional creators, chefs, comedians, models, musicians, and many others, already attract tens of millions of fans on platforms like YouTube and TikTok without the resources or support of more established mass media. Now, as American film and TV production grinds to a halt, possibly for many months, they stand at the center of a major shift that could change entertainment and further blur the lines between traditional and digital frames. Maybe it's partially because of that Noam Chomsky frame of looking at the mainstream media as inherently untrustworthy because it's controlled by the Illuminati, these evil people who are at the top. And, you know, there's an aspect of that that does have some truth to it. But the other future that I see before us is, well, it's potentially dystopian, because the thing that the mainstream media used to offer was that support. How do you get information? Like, let's just think about this, blow this up big for a moment. How do you know that there was an earthquake in Morocco? That happened on the day that I'm recording this. Or a war in Syria. Or how do you know the Vietnam War happened, right? Like, you know these things in two ways. Word of mouth. Vietnam War is a great example. We know that the Vietnam War happened because there was official announcements from the president and the generals and whatnot, and soldiers were sent there and they came back with stories. But we really know what happened in Vietnam because there were scrappy reporters, sort of like me, who were on the ground sending information back to major centralized media. Same with the Iraq War and Afghanistan. But, you know, right now, what do we really know about Ukraine? Yes, there are reporters on the front lines, and there are my brethren who are out there who are risking their lives every day, and they're sending stories back to the New York Times and on their blogs and whatnot. But there's also a tremendous amount of propaganda coming through official channels that are masquerading as social media and masquerading as news, masquerading as verifiable information. But we now live in a world of AI and Midjourney and faked images and faked audio and faked faces. And you know how many of those images of a bomb being dropped from a drone onto a Russian soldier in their foxhole, and there's a whole genre of this type of video, how much of that really happened? How much is fake and how much is just artificially promoted by the propaganda machines of both the Ukrainian propaganda people and the Russian propaganda people? What do we really know that is happening on the ground? And I would argue it's far less right now than what we knew was happening in Afghanistan just a few years ago. And it's because of social media. It's because of this parody that everything has when they show up in a social media feed. As the eminent journalist Michael Lewis said on his podcast, we are living in a world now without referees. We live in a world where the algorithms that are cooked up by Google, who runs YouTube, or the number of followers you have on Facebook matters more than the content that's behind it. And that's because the medium is the message. You know, if you're listening to this right now on Spotify, you're going to see that I have a different title here than I do on YouTube. That's because I have to compete on that level playing field that the algorithm puts up, which is actually not all that level. I need a thumbnail, which is catchy. I need a title that gets your attention before you even open up my document. And some people will say that this is clickbait, that clickbait is bad because it just plays on our emotions and our emotions should not be manipulated by the content producer. Well, it's not really the content producer's fault that you don't click on respected news stories anymore, that you don't go to the New York Times website first for news. People are getting their news from the medium of social media. And it's changing our brains, and it's changing the way information flows. And what is this going to look like? What is my prediction for the future? Well, it's pretty grim. I recently put out pitched a story to all the major magazines that 5 years ago, all of them would be bidding against one another to have in their pages. And instead, what I found was utterly depressing. It was magazines with gutted legal departments, gutted fact-checking teams, scared that their whole publication was about to fall apart and that they would get fired, and they had no ability to take risks anymore. In fact, I had so many fewer publications to go to that eventually I had to take my story out on its own. I mean, I did get offers. I got offers from two big magazines. I'm not going to mention them here officially, but two major magazines that you've definitely heard of wanted it. But one of it wanted such a pared-down version that it wasn't acceptable. The other one wanted to own basically my future. They wanted me to sell everything that comes out of a magazine article, potential books, if I want to do a documentary, anything like that, and I would have nothing, which is not a way that I can support myself. And the situation was so grim that I put it out on my own social media feeds because that actually is where the future is going. in the future, it's not going to be some high clout journalist working for the New York Times. It's going to be the New York Times working for some high clout journalists. And those high clout journalists will be playing the social media game that the Google algorithms and the Facebook algorithms prefer. And that means clickbait titles. That means emotionally engaged headlines. And that means also the declining of editorial standards. And that is the future. And if you happen to be a journalist, well, I'm going to tell you that your job isn't going to be there if you work for one of these magazines soon. I predict that there will only be, let's say, 4 major newspapers left in, let's say, 5 years. This is a bet. And here's my bet who they are. I think it's going to be the New York Times. It's going to be the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and maybe one other. That's going to be the go-to mainstream media. And all of those other magazines and newspapers are going to fall by the wayside. In terms of like mainstream magazines, oh, The Atlantic, maybe Wired, I'm not sure about them. Mother Jones, because they have sort of a support model that's a little different, and just a handful of others. And everything else is going to be, I guess what you could call them would be content creators, where it's the people who can compete on those social media feeds against the TikTok dances and your listicles, whatever's trending on YouTube. They need to be able to compete in that environment. If you are a journalist and you're not building your own little subscription feeds right now, you're going to be obsolete in a few years. That is my dire prediction. You could also join a collective of other small, scrappy reporters. That's another thing that could happen. And a lot of this is going to depend on direct listener support. YouTube videos and ads don't really make all of that much money. And it's going to come down to things like Patreon. It's going to come down to sort of a way that people can sell their products, maybe books. I have books. You can buy my books from these feeds. And it is a game that we are all going to be playing. It's going to be cult of personality journalism. And I really don't like this future, but I can see that it is inevitable because the medium has changed and that changes the message. The medium that we are going to live in for the next generation at least is the social media medium. Heck, most of us are already living this, and it's the media empires that are only just catching up. And with that, I'm going to tell you that's my show for the day. As I asked you earlier, if you could do that social media dance for me and help me achieve the dream of a relevant journalist in the future, your likes and your comments, and maybe you even subscribe to my Patreon, it would be awesome. It is really how this will continue. And the people you support personally are the people who will ultimately survive or fail. And I hate to cast it in such stark terms, but that's just sort of the way it is. From Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado, this was Scott Carney Investigates.